you are allowed to make sure a person is safe and still refuse to be the one holding their hand. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show, and I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. Now, I created this podcast 5 years ago on the floor of my closet because there are so many people out there who don't realize that their recurring problems in their life as an adult is actually a result of their quote-unquote not-so-bad childhood that they swear didn't impact them, who have no idea that the same shit that keeps happening to them, the same relationship, the same job, the same feeling, the same situation, has anything to do with the childhood they'd swear was fine. And I get it, because we are looking back at what happened to us as kids through our adult mind. And the things that happen to us that on their own don't seem like that big of a deal, when they happen to you repeatedly during a time when your sense of self and your nervous system is developing, pack one hell of a punch. This creates our blueprint for relationships, our blueprint for how we see ourselves, our blueprint for our relationship with ourselves, and then you spend your entire adult life confused about why you keep ending up in the same damn place. So if you have started to connect the dots back to your childhood, consider yourself lucky because there are so many people that will go their entire life and never make that realization. So today, folks, we are diving deep with Catherine St. Clair. She is a writer. She is one of us, an adult child. And she has recently become an advocate for something that we've been touching upon recently here on the pod, something that I think needs to be a much bigger conversation than it is, which is, what the hell are you supposed to do when the people who raised you poorly, I might add, the people who raised you poorly, get old and sick and need care? Here's a statistic that she shares in the interview, which kind of blew my mind. Currently, there are 68 million people in the U.S. right now that are taking care of an aging parent, and up to 1 in 4 of them are taking care of a parent who hurt them. 1 in 4. And there is almost nothing out there that is helping these people out. Like, nobody hands you a roadmap for this. Nobody asks whether this is even a parent you should be near. And most people end up thinking they've only got two choices, which are to, you know, take them into your home or just abandon them entirely. Nobody is made aware of the resources and options that are actually available for you. And so that's exactly what Catherine is doing. She's building a resource site that is going to pull everything together all in one place. The resources and the options that are actually available to you from the legal side, the financial side, the care side, so that you can see that you do have more than just those two options. There's a whole middle ground with options and free resources out there that nobody's telling you about. So, and then there's her own story, which, buckle the hell up, okay? This one's wild. This one reads like a thriller. So let's just get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about USU. Need you damn to join Shit Show. This is my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups. We had such a great meeting today. This is where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket, where you can show up and share and not feel like you have to explain yourself, not have to worry about, are people going to think that I'm crazy or weird, or there's something wrong with me because I have, you know, fucked up relationships with my parents, or I don't talk to my parents, or whatever it is. This is a place where you can be seen, heard, and understood like never before by other people who know exactly what it is that you're going through. You know, all of our stories are different, but they're all very, very much the same. And this is just a safe place where you can show up and just be you, and where we also have a little bit of fun, okay? So you, the person who's getting a little itchy right now because they know I'm talking about them, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about we just do it already? This is relational trauma, and we heal relational trauma through safe relationships. And most importantly, through safe relationships with other people who have been through the same shit as you, who are on the same healing journey as you. I'm telling you, it is an absolutely crucial part of this healing journey. It's necessary, and I'm not just saying that. So you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see the link in the show notes next. Give me a follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod, and last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, Catherine. So here's where we're going to start, okay? When was the moment that you realized that your childhood fucked you up more than you thought?
Oh, my gosh.
It could have multiple moments.
Yeah, it's multiple moments, but I will tell you the biggest one was when I became a mother.
Mm. Yes, of course.
Yeah, because it was when I really had to reckon with the fact that they were capable of doing what they did to me and my three sisters when I was, you know, nurturing this little person and looking at how promising she was and how helpless she was and the weight of the responsibility on me as a parent to make sure that I did not injure her. You know, I was acutely aware that she was going to be a woman out in the world someday and bad stuff was going to be happening to her. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't one of those bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I had to deal with the fact that my parents had been okay with being one of those bad things, and not only okay with it, but purposeful about injuring me. And that's a really hard thing to get your head around. And then I, in the act of trying to not parent like my parents, I realized that my internal resources, my ability to feel confidence, my ability to listen to my inner voice, all of those ways that we guide ourselves through challenging situations, I did not have because I was not aware of my inner voice. I had never been taught to listen to it. I had been gaslit my whole life, so I had been taught to negate it. So I was trying to reinvent myself.
Was there a particular moment that allowed you to notice that you didn't have it, or just like the connection with your inner voice or guiding you through difficult situations? Was it something in particular that made you see that, or?
No, honestly, my 30s, the decade when I was having kids and stuff, my ability to self-reflect was pretty suppressed because I was actually just trying to survive.
Yep.
Full-time working mom with a pretty big job. I had to travel. I was having three little kids. My husband traveled too. We lived in a not easy place to live. And I was in survival mode for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in therapy for a while now, like many, many rounds. And when the only times that I really start to cry when I'm in therapy is when I look at that young woman, that 35-year-old, I feel so sorry for her. Because she was absolutely dying and she was completely lost and had no idea how to ask for help. Mm-hmm. So it was more like I look back on it now and I realize why I was struggling and how hard I was struggling. But in the moment, people who grew up like you and me, we don't ask for help. We don't think, oh, this is too much. I can't take all this on myself. I've got to get a support around me. We don't think like that. We just think, I got to go, go, go. I got to keep doing all this stuff because that's how I survive. Right? That was it. It was my consciousness about why that existed, like why my brain worked that way, happened during that same time period. Because I was still very much in a relationship with my parents. I was until very recently. And we were on a vacation together. I have two stories if you want to hear both.
Please.
In the same week, and I swear to God, I walked out of this vacation with my parents just absolutely outside my mind with rage. And I stayed like that for a good couple of years. One evening we're sitting, well, I'll tell you the first one. We rented this cottage on a lake. And there was a road between the cottage and the waterfront. And my kids were like, I want to say 3, 5, and 7. And there was enough distance between the road and the house where an adult couldn't get to them really quickly if they were going to start to try to cross the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I was worried about them trying to go to the water by themselves. So I planned ahead and I brought this little stack of orange caution cones, you know, that my husband was using to coach soccer or whatever, threw them in the car. We get there and I unload them from the car. I take all the kids down. The first thing I did with the caution cones, I lay them out along the bottom of the yard before the road, and I explained to them that this was their stopping point. And they could not cross until an adult was with them. And I was like, I'll be looking. I'll be with you most of the time, but if you happen to go down there, yell up. One of us will come down. Just wait, though. You cannot cross. You have to wait. And they're like, okay, great. And I'm, you know, patting myself on the back, thinking, that's pretty clever, right? You laid out your expectations. You gave them a visual cue. You told them, like, pretty nice, Catherine. Great parenting. So my parents drive up a couple hours later, and we're gonna have like cocktails and dinner with them. And my dad walks in the door and he says, "What's up with those cones?" And I said, "Well, blah, 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 blah." And I explained to him what they were for. And he said, "Well, why don't you just let them try to cross and then hit them?" And I was like, "That's it, right? That's it right there." I never knew why I was putting a step wrong. I never knew why I was getting the shit kicked out of me. I never knew why I was being sequestered in my room for it was a whim. I was set up to fail. I was set up to be hurt physically and emotionally. And there was no awareness of me as an internal person with a separate internal life, right?
Absolutely.
Narcissism 101. That same week, we're sitting around having dinner, and my dad starts to tell this story, and he's laughing and he thinks it's really funny. And he says, "You know, when you guys were little, sometimes when I came home from work, your mom and I would just decide that we had had enough of you. And we didn't want to deal with you for the night. So we would tell you all that you'd been really, really bad that day." And he's laughing. "And we would send you to your rooms for the rest of the night just so we could have some alone time." So, was I aware of what was happening to me as a child? No. But guess what? I'm a lifelong insomniac. Since childhood, I lie down in the bed every single night and I go through the checklist, the roster, everything that I fell short on that day, every way that I failed somebody, every time that I fucked up. I used to go lie on my children's floors in the middle of the night and force myself to sleep on the floor in penance for whatever mistake I thought I had made with them that day. So he thinks it's funny and it's no big deal, but it literally shaped my sleep pattern for the rest of my life, which has tons of health implications and mental health implications and all of these things. And I remember I said to him, "That's really not very funny. That's very fucked up." And he was like, "Oh, give me a break." So, you know, I'm in this decade of having kids, raising kids, really trying to like hold back the dam. And my parents could not help themselves but show me who they were. And they made it over time just so much harder to keep forgiving them and contextualizing and understanding that, yes, they had had a rough childhood, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, and there are lots of real concrete reasons why I'm not in a relationship with them. But that was the moment that I really stopped trusting my parents with my,
Kids.
yeah, and my life, like my feelings about things. It was just a very clear moment that they had absolutely no regard for me as a human being.
I just made a post about that recently last week because we were talking about it in my group about the withdrawal as punishment. One of the most damaging things a parent can do is withdraw as a punishment when their love could be pulled away at any moment for any reason. You don't know what you did. You don't know how long it'll last. You don't know what you can do to fix it.
Yeah. So, of course, then the literature shows that a kid then thinks I'm the problem,
Of course.
right? So, all of that gets turned in on us. And then we go through life thinking that we're bad and that everything is temporary and that love isn't real and all of those things.
So you were one of four. Where did you fall in line?
Second.
Second. Okay. And did you play a particular family role?
I was the middle child because there was an oldest, youngest, and an only boy.
Okay.
And so I was just the one who sort of fell in the middle of all of that. And I wasn't really everybody else. I was the Cassandra of the family. I was the one who called bullshit on stuff. I was the first one to go far away. I was the first one to diverge politically from my parents. I was a feminist from a really young age and vocal about it in a house where my mother was incredibly disempowered. So I definitely didn't fit the mold. I was a little bit alternative. I had a little, asymmetrical one-sided bob. I had the red lipstick and the Doc Martens and the whole thing. And they thought I was a little freaky.
So you were a
So
scapegoat.
yeah. And I was the one who I wasn't conscious of this. I just wasn't a reflection of them. I wasn't what they wanted me to be. So, and I wasn't a bad kid. I was a great kid. I played flute. I was on the swim team. I got good grades. I wasn't balling around with the football team, but I just wasn't what they pictured, really.
Was there a classic golden child?
Yes, the youngest. My youngest sister.
And was it a reflection from your dad or your mom?
That's interesting because I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to clarify it. My mother thought the sun rose and set in her. My dad didn't like her at all. I think he was a little bit jealous, I guess. It was a story that my parents told that they had three kids. If you can even imagine, I mean, I know this happens, but they tell this story. Or told it. They have three kids, and my mom wants to have a fourth, and my dad doesn't want to have a fourth. So the story is she got him drunk and jumped his bones, and then there was my youngest sister. So the narrative started out, mom wanted you, dad didn't. So, and then my youngest sister really became my mother's protector. I don't know if we've talked about this yet, but it was a house, domestic violence was the norm in my house. So my parents didn't fight. There were violent beatings. And so my youngest sister was the person who would go to the store with my mom after my mom had had the shit kicked out of her. She'd be wearing big sunglasses over her black eyes. And, my sister would be out there trying to please her by buying her a Baby Ruth bar and stuff like that so that she. So that was her role. It was a very enmeshed relationship between the two of them and a very dismissive relationship between
From your
her and my
dad.
dad.
And did your dad take favorite anyone?
The oldest. But as a water carrier, she was probably the most perfect in terms of what they wanted in a child. She was a real reflection of both of them. And so that won her a lot of favor. But as the eldest, she also was responsible for so much. She was the little adult. She had to absorb things. She felt like she had to protect us. And it's done a number on her. It's very hard for her to own a lot of stuff that happened because,
She feels partly responsible.
yeah.
And was there camaraderie amongst the kids?
Yeah, there very much was. So we're still, this is a big part of the story, actually. And when I'm writing about it in my book, I'm not focusing on it that much because it is not my story to tell, but it's a real important part of the story in terms of the level of emotional, physical, and psychological neglect that my parents practiced. My third sister was born assigned male and transitioned later in life. And I have her permission to talk about this because, as a trans woman, she's living her life out loud and she doesn't want to hide anything. But the story is that when she was 8 years old, there was a doctor who lived across the street from our house in our neighborhood. He was actually the collegiate football team physician.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a college town. So he was a little bit famous, you know, in the circle of whatever, people who cared about that shit. And my then brother was sent across the street to get a physical and just had to have a form signed so he could join a little soccer team. And he came back. And this is, I'm being told this by my sister. I did not witness this. I was not there. But she came back and said to my dad, something weird happened, and described what the doctor had done. And my dad said, that's okay. That's just a big boy exam. They'll all be like that from now on. So my sister was actually raped for 10 years by the doctor who lived across the street from us. Honestly, I wasn't aware of it until my mid 40s, because that's when she called and said, I'm transitioning, and I was raped by the doctor across the street for so many years. It was a lot to get our heads around, really, really intense time period. Obviously, that's a selfish thing to say because it was much more intense for her. But I had heard that there was a class action lawsuit that was starting against this doctor. He had already died, but it was against his estate, but also the university for not protecting all these young men. So my sister actually participated in the class action lawsuit, and she received the largest personal settlement out of the 2,000 young men who brought suit against the university, because her abuse was deemed to be the longest term and the most egregious. But that was the beginning of the neglect of her. But she attempted suicide in high school. She developed a drinking problem very young. When she was in college, she checked herself into a mental health institution. And all of that was swept under the rug and ignored. There was no treatment, there was no help, because that wasn't what we were supposed to look like.
Yeah, of course.
So she struggled for a good 20 years just getting her basic shit together. She was doing lots of really sexually risky things. She was falling asleep drunk in her car on the side of the road. It was a really, really bad time. And it's all an outgrowth of not getting the care that she needed, starting at age 8 all the way through. And my parents are aware of this now and still don't acknowledge that there was something they should have done. Yeah.
Were you aware as a kid that what was happening in your home wasn't normal?
Nope.
Yeah.
Not till college, when I would sit, you know, you're in your first dorm and you get to know people, you're sitting on the dorm floor drinking something stupid because you don't know how to drink yet. And everyone's telling stories. And I was listening to people talk about how their parents fought and then how they were disciplined. And I was just like, geez, that is not how it went down in my house. And that's when I really started to understand that something bad had been happening. But what's weird about that is, like, God, our brains do a number on us, don't they? We had all intervened directly in the violence between our parents many times. And just to be clear, the violence did not stop with her. Of course, we were all physically abused as well, not just 70s spanking, actual really bad stuff. So we had all intervened and seen the violence up close. It's just weird that you can convince yourself that that's normal, even though it requires that level of intervention from you. Like, why did I not know that was fucked up?
I think you're too busy just trying to survive than you are about thinking about whether this is normal or not. What about in the makeup between your mom and your dad? What were their cycles?
The cycle was absolutely no idea what the lead up to an eruption was going to be. An unbelievably violent eruption, and then unbelievable violence that involved all of us, and then pin drops. Nothing. Nothing. 30 minutes later, they would call us to dinner, and everybody would sit down and pretend that nothing ever happened.
I think that can be the most damaging aspect of it, right? Is like that part of it.
Well, you said earlier, that's the crazy making stuff. Because you're still formulating Is this world real? What's my role in it? How do I occupy my what space do I occupy in this world? But everything that you see, you're being told never happened. Every feeling that you have, you're not allowed to feel. So yeah, I think I was off my feet for most of my childhood, really not understanding what was happening.
And so then after those two incidences with your when you went on that vacation with your parents, did you start to shift your dynamics with them?
Yeah, I did. I just did not share any personal information with them anymore. Anything that meant something to me privately, I did not talk to them. I didn't think that I could trust them. Well, they had shown that I couldn't trust them. You know, during this decade, my husband and I also hit a marital road bump because, yeah, married for 10 years, three kids, two careers, lots of stuff going on, tons of stress and pressure. And we had trouble for a little while and we went into marriage counseling. And my parents took that as an opportunity to go on the dinner party circuit in my hometown and tell everybody some crazy shit. One of their favorite ones was that my husband was wanted by the FBI for embezzlement.
Exciting.
No, yeah, I was like, I don't even know how that would happen, but okay. So I knew I couldn't trust him. And it stayed like that. On the surface, our relationship looked very much the same. I just didn't try to get them to know me anymore.
When did you really start diving into, in a therapeutic sense, the impact of your childhood?
I tried in my 20s. I tried in my 30s. Again, I don't think I was in the best hands. And then again in my 40s, I made much more headway. The marriage counseling journey with my husband actually turned into individual counseling for me, because a lot of this stuff came out. And I started understanding that I had a lot of things I needed to work on that were affecting my marriage and my life and things. And so that was probably the most constructive time period. And then now, because I'm dealing with the ramifications of what happened a couple of years ago.
So were you mostly like an overfunctioner? Was that kind of your trauma response?
And a little bit of a rebel in terms of I have real problems with authority. I don't like being told what to do. If I disagree with the premise, my question about everything is why? Why? Why do I have to? Why can't I? Because I've seen so much bullshit that an adult telling me something is not an automatic thing for me to adhere to. I'm a huge skeptic and I have an incredibly low threshold for any bullshit at all. So anybody not being authentic is just not, I just don't do it.
Yeah, I don't either. Not here
It's a
for it.
waste of time. Why?
Yeah. So then, was there a moment where you officially cut off contact with your parents?
Yeah.
And what led up to that?
So my dad was diagnosed with cancer. This was now, sometimes I forget the year, but I think it was about, yeah, 8 or 9 years ago now.
First, let me ask you this. What do you know about his upbringing?
I know everything about his upbringing and my mother's upbringing. And it's funny, I spoke in front of a group of social workers just 2 days ago in Wisconsin. It was a lovely, lovely group of people. And their questions were really good. When I was done talking, it was a long Q&A session, and one of the people in attendance said, "You know, have you ever been able to contextualize your parents' behaviors and use that to help you understand them?" And my response was, "Oh yeah, but that was on purpose. That was so I would excuse their behaviors. I was fed my parents' victim narratives like pudding." And it was so that there was a built-in excuse. So I actually, yeah, my dad had a rough upbringing. His father walked out when he was young. His mother was an alcoholic and I think a sex worker at a certain point. My mother just had very distant parents. There was a lot of emotional neglect and she was definitely not prioritized. And, you know, her father blocked her from the profession that she wanted to practice. And so they definitely set themselves up as victims who needed to be pitied and excused. My dad's favorite mantra was, I grew up without a father. I was never taught how to be a man. So after violence and horrible behaviors and everything, he would always cry and then say, I was never taught how, I didn't have a father. I was never taught how to be a man. So the person who asked me that the other day in this forum, my answer was, it actually is their backstories are actually why I spent way too many years understanding and forgiving. Because I thought they couldn't do any better.
Well, I mean, I think that that can be true and that doesn't make it okay.
True.
I
True.
think like we can hold room for both. I think that, well, that is, it's the spiritual bypassing part of it. I don't think that anyone can get to a place, and this is the way that I talk about it for myself. It's like, you have to experience all of the feelings that you didn't like get to rightly feel as a kid for what you went through, right? And so once you go through all of that, then, and this isn't to say that this is for everyone. And I don't even say forgiveness, but maybe like an acceptance of who they are. But then it's like new things will come up for me and I'll vacillate back to feeling angry, And so I think that there can be this ebb and flow, but like getting to a place of understanding before you've even really acknowledged or felt what you went through, then yeah, that'll keep you real stuck.
It really will. And I like what you just said that, yes, I think part of the journey is being prepared for or just accepting that you do go back and forth. And I think to your point of acceptance, I have accepted who my parents are. I have. I don't forgive them, but I accept it. But that acceptance is also part of my knowing how unsafe they are to be in my life in any form. So that if I accept who they are, I'm also simultaneously accepting that they will never ever be anything different. And if they cannot be different, they are unsafe for me.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, I think that people sometimes twist it and they make it seem like acceptance or forgiveness means like just that they're going to be in your life or that, and it's not. It's just kind of getting more to a place of where you're not just constantly in a place of like real resentment or where that, it's really eating you alive, which again, all those feelings are valid. And like we have to spend a long, like the goal is hopefully to not spend the rest of your life in that place, though.
Right,
Hopefully.
exactly. And I think what I learned was that being in contact with them was what was continuing to eat me
Absolutely.
alive.
Because you're continuing to put yourself in a position to be hurt. All right, shit shows. Do you ever have those days where everything takes you three times longer than you thought it would? I'll be honest, I have those days multiple times a week. And so then 6 p.m. rolls around and I've checked off like half my to-do list, and going to the grocery store is one of those things I've yet to do. Now, this is usually the moment that my inner critic loves to come in to start shaming me about how irresponsible I am, how I can't get it together, what the hell's wrong with me. But then I remember I have Omaha steaks in the freezer, and the critic no longer has a dinner crisis to shame me over. Now, having Omaha steaks in the freezer is like having a trusted butcher in a gourmet food shop right in my house. And let's talk about the flavor of these steaks, okay? Because when I buy steak at the grocery store, unless I marinate them ahead of time, it usually comes out kind of flavorless. But with Omaha steaks, I don't have to do a damn thing. No marinating, no planning, no thinking ahead. It is flavorful all on its own. And there's also a nostalgic thing going on for me because my grandma, my dad's mom, she always gave us Omaha steaks every Christmas. And she was one of the few people that I felt truly unconditionally loved by. So there is a warmth to this that goes beyond just the way that they taste. Omaha Steaks has been around for over 100 years. It is the same damn beef people have trusted in their kitchen for generations, shipped nationwide straight to your damn door, arriving frozen, ready for grilling, searing, and roasting with minimal time and effort. I personally like to cook my steaks in the air fryer. So traditionally, I've been a ribeye gal, but let me tell you about what I most recently got. The burger Burger Perfection Flight. For just $79.99, you get 20 premium steak burgers crafted from 5 distinct cuts of steak. So you can try the Burger Perfection Flight at Omaha Steaks today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get 35% off with promo code BEEF. So that's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for 35% off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
Yeah. So let me explain how this all, the initial estrangement came to pass. So 8 or 9 years ago, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. It wasn't going to be a fatal kind of cancer, but it was going to require chemo and radiation and then removal of an organ. And my youngest sister is an oncologist and a very good one. And she, this is the enmeshment just right coming to the fore. She felt very strongly that my parents move in with her and her family so that she could do his chemo at her hospital, oversee the whole thing. Well, we live in a college town. There was an excellent hospital there. He could have been taken care of very, very well, and the outcome probably wouldn't have been any different. But she felt very strongly that she was the one who had to do it. That's how much we felt responsible for the health and welfare of our own parents. So that's just a classic example in an extreme way. So they move in with my sister, her husband, and their 4 children. One of my other sisters and I would parachute in on the weekends and sort of just help whatever we can, try to be a buffer and stuff like that. On one weekend that I was in town with her, we were trying to get our dad to drink water and to take a walk down the driveway because he was wrapping up chemo and he was going to have to return back to his town and have the surgery. And in order to do that, he had to, his blood levels had to be at a certain, you know, he had to be healthy enough to withstand the surgery, basically. So he needed to do these things. He was refusing. We were asking him very kindly. I was going to walk down the driveway with him. He erupted into one of his unbelievable violent fits. I do not know where the energy came from. The guy was naked with his fucking, you know, chemo portal still in his on his chest, screaming in my sister's face, spit flying all over her. It was so bad, I had to take her 4 children out of the house, run upstairs, grab them, take them outside, say to her husband, you need to get in there. He had to say, you know, calm my dad down. They go back, he has his surgery, and then it's a rotation of me and my sisters coming in and taking care of the post-op care and stuff like that. In this 48-hour time period, it becomes abundantly clear that my mother is in active, severe alcoholism. And so they took the first shift. I took the second shift. I had to come in and take my mom to rehab. So just, you know, been through cancer treatment, a surgery, unbelievable mistreatment by them, and then taking my mother to rehab. At a certain point, like, that's enough. You know, like, what the fuck else? What other fire drill are you going to throw at us? Are you kidding? So I sit my parents down and I say, you guys are a mess. Your finances are a mess. Your life is a mess. Your health is a mess. Your relationship is a disaster. We cannot help you anymore. You have to close your doors and figure this stuff out. I am at this point 49 years old and he goes crazy on me. You never loved me. Everyone feels sorry for me that you're my daughter. We're writing you out of the will. Get out of here and never come back. So I said, okay. And he didn't think that it was going to stick, and it stuck. And then it stuck with my other 3 siblings too, all of whom who came to their own conclusions in their own time. There was no communication between us about, well, I'm going to do this. Are you going to do this? It was just so obvious and so pervasive that there was nothing left to be done for them. And so that lasted for a couple of years. I attempted, well, they attempted with me 2 reconciliation conversations that went so unbelievably poorly. It was textbook, like, narcissistic reversal. And what was interesting was the beginning of both of those conversations, my mother's first words to me, both of them, were, I'm not going to talk about your childhood. Okay. Well, if you didn't think you did anything wrong, you'd be willing to talk about it. So what that initial estrangement lasted for 4 years until, and it's interesting, the last 6 months of that 4 years is when I started writing my book. And I sat down and I just thought, I'd studied writing in college. I'd always wanted to write a book. I had been doing life and I couldn't do it. I had stopped working. I was a teacher and I'd stopped working and I thought, well, this is my window. I want to start writing. So I sat down and I started writing for 6 months. And really, what I was trying to do was make sense of the duality of my childhood. You know, how do you grow up in a family where there is love, where there's food, there's support, there's education? You know, college was paid for. I had a nice wedding, all that. How do you make, and I loved my parents. How do you make that make sense with the other horrible things that happen? I wanted to write stories that were just exploring the duality of growing up like that and what that does to a mind, you know, what the confusion, how that manifests, right? I'm sure this, you deal with this all the time. So on a Sunday afternoon in March of 2024, my phone rings and it's my sister, and she says, Dad has just been arrested for trying to strangle mom to death. He's in jail. So he'd been beating her for 60 years and nothing had ever happened. No one ever called the authorities. And he went to jail.
Did your mom call the cops or?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. I'm sure that you're following this, but there is a representative in Congress right now who is in the hot seat because his wife has accused him of domestic violence and I guess of hurting their young daughter also. And he did a social media post a little while ago that's still getting a lot of play, saying, you know, if I had done this, would she have cooked dinner for me 2 weeks later? Would she have taken our daughter to a birthday party the next day? Would she have? The answer is, hell yeah, she would have. I've watched that happen my whole life. My mother almost died, and she went to church the next morning and sang in the choir. And she went to the pastor of the church and said, you know, my husband tried to strangle me last night. There were marks on her neck. And so the pastor's a mandated reporter. And she said, I have to call the police. Do you want me to call the police? And my mother said, yes. She was asked later that day, if this has been happening your whole life, why did you want to call the police now? And her response was, I was just sick of it. So my ideas about my mom and not being protected and the violence and stuff are incredibly complicated. As a feminist, I have a lot of problems with them, but it is how I feel. You know, I was put in harm's way on purpose for my entire life, and decisions and choices were made. So it's horrible that that's her story. Absolutely horrible. Tried to rescue her hundreds of times and couldn't do it. But in the end, she just got sick of it. So that
Was he
pastor,
charged?
yes.
How long was he in
Yes.
jail?
6 months, but he got a five year sentence. He's serving time now. Yeah.
How old is he?
He is 85 this month. So he was 82.
And so then, obviously, it was just a long process, like had to go to court. Like, was it taken fully to court?
So this is actually now what I'm talking about, because this is this unmet need that I think is incredibly important and that is only going to get more significant as that population ages and as this no contact estrangement conversation becomes more pervasive or larger, if we think it is. By 9:30 that night, my sister and I were co-opted. We were told by the pastor at their church that she had secured an elder care attorney and a geriatric care specialist, and that we were going to become the legal guardians and custodians of both of our parents. So after 4 years of estrangement, a lifetime of abuse, and a conscious decision to walk away from my extremely harmful parents, I had 6 hours to get my head around becoming their legal caretaker, both of them at the same time.
Was there not a way for you to decline it?
It gets really complicated here too. My sister said she was going to do it. And I made the conscious choice that I could not leave her alone to do it, that was too big of a burden for her to carry. I knew that the way our childhood had manifested in her was this overdeveloped sense of responsibility and loyalty. That was the number that was done on her, you know? And I was ready to say, fuck them. But my sister was saying yes. And so I had to say yes.
You didn't have to,
So
but you chose to.
I chose to out of that bond. So the two of us did it together. And over 6 months, I had to go to court. I had to testify in open court as to my parents' incompetence. It took us 6 months to unravel their finances. They were in debt. They didn't have an established doctor. There was no health care happening. There were bills that weren't being paid. Their taxes were in arrears. He was in jail. We had to make the decision to not post bail and keep him in jail while the criminal proceedings worked their way through the system, because we were worried for his safety and hers. We thought there was a possibility we were going to have like a murder-suicide on our hands. So we had to make that decision. Don't even really want to, like, how do you even describe what that's like? You're 50 something years old and you sit there and say, yeah, my 82-year-old dad has to stay in jail. It's the safest place for everybody. I mean, Jesus Christ, right? So we had to write victim impact statements because we were told that by the arresting detective that our county was lenient on domestic violence issues and that they would probably chalk it up to, and this is a quote, a whoopsie moment, a senior whoopsie moment, and that he would be released with a slap on the wrist. And that was also unsafe. So we all submitted, all of us separately submitted victim impact statements that were then held up in one of the criminal proceedings by the county prosecutor saying, I have 20 pages here written by this man's children saying this is a lifelong pattern and that he's dangerous. So in the end, he pled guilty.
Did this all happen while he was still in custody? Or did he get
Yes.
out? Okay.
He was never out.
Did your mom have to testify?
No.
Was your mom speaking to him when he was in jail?
No, there was a restraining order and there is a restraining order, and as they are both still living, and as long as they're both still living, there will be a restraining order.
Wow. Okay. Continue. So he pled guilty. Okay.
He pled guilty and he was sentenced to 5 years. The maximum was 10 in that state for that offense. And so 5 years. And when he was standing and being sentenced, the judge was admonishing him. And guess what he said? I grew up without a father. I was
I never
never
learned how
taught
to be
how
a
to be a
man.
man. And I was like, I mean, if that's not a bookend, I don't know what is. You know, like that was the mantra. And she said, that no longer matters. And she hit the gavel, and that was it. Kicker that he was too frail and old to go to actual prison. So they sentenced him to house arrest. So we had to find a locked facility. It fell on the family to find a locked facility where he could serve out his 5 years. We had to find a place that would take a felon with mental health issues. And that's where he is now.
So what is it? It's like a senior living.
So he can't leave. At the end of those 6 months, my sister and I surrendered the legal responsibilities. We went back to court, handed it over to a third party. So the story now that I'm really interested in talking about is the numbers of people like me who are adult child of abuse whose parents now need care, they are the people who are doing it. And it is incredibly re-traumatizing. It is unbelievably unmanageable. It's a burden in all of the ways that regular caretaking is, and that's bad enough. But to have to do that for someone who harmed you is exceptionally egregious. So what I've been doing is I've been getting more involved in social media, but I also, because of the way my brain works, I decided I wanted to like figure out how many are there like me? Adult children of abuse who are now responsible for caring for their elderly parents. And what do we know about these people? Is anyone researching it? Does anyone talking about it? So what I found was two researchers at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Ju-Yong Kong and Dr. Jamie Goldberg, who are the only people looking into this quantitatively and qualitatively at the Graduate School of Social Work there. And I reached out to them. That's my alma mater. So I just kind of shot my shot and was like, hi, can I talk to you? And that first conversation has now turned into a partnership. I am creating a website called caringforabusiveparents.org. I'm writing a book. Well, I've written the book. I am starting to, talk about putting it out there a little bit. And I'm beginning speaking about this publicly. I spoke to social workers this week, going to be doing more of that. I'm going to be speaking on college campuses in family violence classes because the numbers show, and this is Dr. Kong's research and Dr. Goldberg's, up to 26% of the, I think it's 68 million people in this country right now that are caring for an elderly parent, up to 1 in 4 of those are caring for a parent who harmed them. And it's as graphic as someone who was molested sexually by her father is now doing bathing and toileting of that father. So think about the physical proximity, having to deal with that person's body and not feeling like you have any other options. But the thing is, we do have other options. There are services, there are government services, all the way down to the county level, where you can get help to care for an elderly parent without you having to do it. You can get financial planning help. You can get the legal help that you need. You can get the health, welfare, and housing help that you need so that you can do it sort of the way my sister and I did it, which is listen, we're going to do all the due diligence. We're going to set all this up, but then we're going to walk away. So there are all of these sibling obligations, societal pressures. My story is an example of how those things all came to play and why I ended up in the situation that I was in. That is very, very common. But nobody really understands that there's a middle ground. People are like, fuck them, they're gonna die in the street, or I'm gonna have to take them into my house and take care of their every need. You don't have to re-victimize yourself like that again. So I'm kind of making it my mission now to communicate with as many people as I can about this population in general, that this is a really, really burgeoning, serious problem, and that it needs to be addressed. A lot of what I was talking about with the social workers the other day was what these people look like when they come in to the hospital setting or the community, they're not going to look like
Of
families that are
course,
healthy,
yes.
right? And you can't handle them the same way that you handle families that are healthy. A hospice nurse saying, you should, calling someone and saying, you're the next of kin, you really should come and sit. Your father is ready to go, and you need to come hold his hand and tell him that you love him. Don't do that. You have no idea what that person has been through.
I think some families, though, can mask like they look like they're healthy. Like I would think most of them, you probably can't tell, honestly.
So there was in this study, the study was published in Clinical Gerontology in 2021, and one of the people who was involved in the study said, they don't have to just ask me. Are there any mitigating circumstances? Is there anything I need to know about your family dynamic? Is there anything you want to share with me about your relationship with this parent? Don't assume a level of love and obligation that might not be there, because it translates as pressure and guilt to a person who's probably torn to shit about having to go through this anyway. And having, I mean, at least for me, it took me decades to get to the point where I could say, I'm not going to do this. So I just, there, this was covered, I think June 15th, the New York Times Magazine had a large piece on it. It was just covered in the Wall Street Journal, although from a different angle. And I really think it's about to become a discussion that a lot of people need to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I had an author on recently, like a couple months ago, and she wrote a book about this. She's a therapist. She's from the US, but she lives over in France. But what was it called? I think it has betr what was it? The obligation wound. She was great. I really loved her. Let me get her name for you.
I'll just
Her
look up the book. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
The
great.
Obligation Wound. And it's specifically about dealing with aging narcissistic parents. So, okay, I need to tie up some pieces just so for myself, because I'm somebody that needs to know all the information in the story. So then, how did your mom do after that?
Really, 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 really badly.
Yeah.
But wonderfully for her. Just really badly as a parent.
Yeah.
My sister had to go to the house one day. She had to go with the attorney to make sure that she could actually get everything she needed to gather paperwork so that we could start to make sense. I mean, we had to do forensic accounting to try to figure out what the hell had been going on with these people. And my sister had an exchange with my mom where my mom was like, "Hey, how are you doing?" Like all bubbly. I mean, 72 hours later, right? And my sister says, "Well, actually, I'm doing very, very poorly." And her response to her was, "Oh, give me a break. This has nothing to do with you." So we had already been to court. It very much had everything to do with us. From a legal standpoint, of course it did. But of course, from an emotional standpoint,
Even
it
more so,
did.
yes.
But she did not, again, like they just keep showing you these. Who they are. We were not separate people with emotional lives. And so when the shit show became a public legal shit show, it was treated the same as a beating before Sunday dinner was treated. It never happened.
I was
So
wondering
she's.
if she was going to completely fall apart with him being gone, because I imagine their relationship is so codependent.
Now she's living her best life.
Wow.
She has a boyfriend.
And does your sister have a relationship with her?
None
Does
of us do.
anybody? None.
Nope. No. I mean, they're not gonna, no one's gonna be at anybody's bedside.
Has she tried to reach out at all?
Nope.
And what about your dad? When is his sentence over?
2.5 years. His guardian asked him one day if he wanted to write us letters. And she said, "I will bring you some stationery and you can write all your kids' letters." And he said, I've never had very good handwriting.
Yeah, you know, at that age, I just even think about it with my own parents, and I mean, my parents are nothing like when you would consider them on the same like playing field. They've done a lot of shitty things, but not to this extent. The changes to the brain, you know, the mental defenses that have had to have been built in to be able to just live every day with that amount of shame, you
Yeah.
know, like it is so locked away. You know what I mean? It is in a million boxes and locked doors, and I mean, it's completely inaccessible. Like at this point, you know, like they
Yeah.
can't, there's no way that they could face something like that, you know?
No.
Yeah, man, it is, it's tragic.
It is. It's really, really tragic. My focus is, on my siblings, and miraculously, we're all okay. And there were a lot of protective factors in our lives. Like I said, I lived in a neighborhood. We had enough money. There was good nutrition. We were educated. We had some consistencies in our lives. Without those things, we would be sociopaths. But because we had those things, and because we had each other, We're okay. All of us have made secure attachments with a partner, and we have broken some cycles with our own kids. It's not perfect, no parenting is perfect, but we definitely are in a better spot than we could have been in so many other scenarios.
I'm curious. So, when you're talking about the various resources that are available, I mean, they're available, but is the process, is it rather difficult, like to actually be able to, like, what is the accessibility or the likelihood of actually being able to utilize them?
That's a really good question. And it's honestly something that I'm exploring right now. The two professors at Wisconsin are advisors with me on this website. And then I have another advisor who is a professional financial manager for specifically for elder care. And then I have a geriatric care specialist working with me. So I'm trying to get like the three legs of the stool that allow you to plan for the care of an elderly person. I'm trying to make sure all of those buckets are covered. So, the premise of this is that if you're somebody like me, you are facing a decision if ever to, if never to, or to what degree to care for your parent. And in order to do that, you need information. So, I'm just trying to put all of the information in one spot where a person like me can go to it and say, okay, let me educate myself about what I have to do here. And if they even want to, let me educate myself about what I am. Is it worth it to me to do 3 months of some work to set all of this up so that I can meet whatever obligation I feel that society asked me to, my siblings, my church, whatever it is, I can meet those obligations and then walk away. How do I think of myself as the case study. My parents are now cared for. They are housed, they are fed, they have better health care than when they were running it themselves. You can do that without putting that on you. Did it take some initial investment? Absolutely. So we had to get that system set up. And you could hop on this website when it's live and say, I don't want to do any of this shit. And that is absolutely great. Good on you. Don't do it. You might be someone who says, these are things I'm willing to manage for my parent. I'll put these things in play and then I will be the person to do this. Also great. Or you can be someone like me who says, I'm going to set it up and then I'm going to walk. But the point is, there are services that allow you to choose whatever level of protection you need so that you feel safe and you're meeting the obligation that you feel for your parent. So it's not easy. It would take some legwork to get it done. And resources are definitely an issue, but that's why we're working really hard to make sure that even somebody who has no resources will be able to access certain things. There are people who do pro bono work, and there are Medicaid, Medicare programs that do this. There are voucher systems and things like this. So you can do it with very few economic resources also.
Does it seem to really vary state by state, or is it mostly federal programs?
It's mostly federal programs. I went down a rabbit hole where I was trying to find really, really grassroots organizations because I thought on a county level that might be very important for people. But the problem with that is that landscape shifts so much, and those links, literally, the links to these organizations, and they change all the time. And I don't want to create this tool and then put it out there and have it become defunct quickly. So, most of it is going to be federal programs that then drill down into state and county programs, including how to find an elder care attorney. You can search them by zip code, and you can find it's not a huge financial investment. A couple thousand dollars might sound like a lot, but it's not a lot if you never have to do anything again, right? And there are people who do that work pro bono if you don't have that. There are legal guardians who will take guardian ad litem, it's called, who will take legal custody of your parents and do it for free. They take pro bono clients. So that's the idea, is I want to take the stuff that's most reputable, things that are licensed, And drill down so that people can find local services where they live, but a lot of them are nationally based.
I really think that looking at that book would be really interesting for you because one of the things about it, and I think that helps make these sort of decisions with clarity, is to be able to identify all the different parts of you that are coming up around this. Like, what are all the different feelings that you have? You have all these younger parts of you that have all these different feelings that are coming into play here. And so how do you get your adult self in the driver's seat to really, make a decision and not having it be all these younger parts of you taking the wheel and making a decision based off that?
Yeah, I mean it's a struggle. I have a really good therapist now doing a lot of work. All my siblings are too, and it takes a lot. It's, I wake up some mornings and I'm still just profoundly sad. But
Yes, of course.
yeah.
How could you not
So
be? How are the dynamics and relationships amongst your siblings? Like, has this brought you guys closer together?
everybody is handling things differently. We were always close. We're probably closer, because we really did rescue each other. I mean, each one of us has had a really rough go of it. It's grief, grieving parents who are not dead, and that's really rough.
Yeah, no kidding. It is rough.
Yeah.
That ambiguous grief.
Yeah, it's really hard, death without a body. And people in the beginning would say, "But you're gonna work it out though, right?" And I was like, "I don't know what the fuck you just said. Like, how much more is one person supposed to tolerate?" But very few people actually said that stuff to us because this is just so out there. Like,
Yes, no kidding.
yeah.
Is there any sense of justice that your dad ended up locked up?
Yeah. I will say it's interesting. I don't think about this very often, but I'm glad you asked it. There was something very profound about watching that court proceeding and watching our words get held up on paper and entered into the record. It was like being seen for the first time, that our story was on those pages, in those words, and someone believed us. And it's one of the reasons why, like, before I started writing this book, well, not before, when I started writing this book again, after I worked through the whole process, I had to take a break. Obviously, you can't live through that and be writing about it at the same time. I did have a conversation with a lawyer and I was like, "What's my exposure, writing my story? These people are still alive and there is going to be some identifying information in it and stuff like that." And he was like, "Well, I mean, honestly," it was a Second Amendment lawyer, and he said, "The truth is your biggest defense." But then I also realized those pages, they were held up in a criminal court. They were entered into the record,
Yeah, legal
and they
record.
were used to convict and sentence somebody for a crime. So the state that I'm from, they accepted that as the truth, right? And what's in those words is what I'm writing about. So that makes me feel like, I mean, this is legally accepted truth, Can't do anything about that.
Was he emotionless throughout the whole trial?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, a frail kind of emotionless. It wasn't.
Well, had he been in, he was in regular jail.
Yes, he was in regular jail for 6 months.
That probably did a number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, I
Wow.
gotta say, like, jarring is not the right word. I had to suck down a very large glass of wine after watching that one because you see your dad in a jumpsuit, cuffed, disheveled, frail, talking to a judge. And it is a very, very
Surreal. Yeah. No
gutting.
kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Wow.
my wonderful husband said, "You don't have to watch any more of the proceedings. I'll do it for you and I'll just tell you what happened." Because I was like, "I can't do that again."
Could you watch it on online?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So as of now, is there anything, are there any resources that you want me to put in the show notes, or is just kind of like stay tuned and on a website, or what's the deal?
What's your timing about when this is going to
I'll probably
air?
release it soon.
Soon. Okay. So it's coming. My goal is September.
Okay.
to have this website live.
So, should I just direct them to your Instagram for now, or do you have a regular website or what?
No, do my Instagram's great.
Okay, perfect. Well, I really appreciate, you sharing. I mean, this is a good one. I haven't gotten this one yet. I've talked to a lot of families. This is one I've yet to hear. Haven't had
Is a
anyone's
unique
parents end up in
story.
jail and in their 80s. So,
Like, Jesus Christ, aren't you
yeah, and
tired
thank you for
yet?
yeah, thanks for what you're doing. And this is a really big problem, and it's going to become a bigger problem. So, really appreciate somebody's taking some action to
I really
help some
appreciate
folks out.
being given the forum. I hope I can. I'm trying to make this tool not crack so that it actually will be helpful for somebody.